Our second speaker is Rabbi Tzvi David Rum, who's also spoken for us before. Rabbi Rum is the rabbi of the historic Bialystok Synagogue on the Lower East Side. He is a Maggid Shir at the Isaac Breuer College of Yeshiva University. And we're, again, very, very pleased to have him here. Rabbi Rum.
Thank you very much for the introduction. It's always a tremendous, first of all, a tremendous pleasure to be able to join the Torah Masorah Wednesday morning women's lecture series. It's a tremendous personal pleasure. It's always a pleasure to be able to welcome so many people from our own neighborhood who are able to make it all the way up to 34th Street, the wilds of Midtown. And particularly, I have to say, as I say every year, but I think this year it's particularly acute, it's a tremendous source of inspiration to come out on a day where I think the official temperature is 17 degrees, if I'm not mistaken. 20, okay, no. Baruch Hashem, we warmed it up a little bit. But certainly, it's a chilly day, it's a cold day, it's a difficult day. You ask the average person what they would want to do today, the average person would say, I just want to stay indoors and put on the heat as high as I possibly can. And here, Baruch Hashem, we have over three tables of dedicated women whose idea of what to do on a cold day is exactly the same idea as what they would do on a warm day, to come out and to hear words of Torah and to hear the words of Chizuk. So it's a tremendous source of Chizuk to me as the speaker, to be able to see so many women who, despite, you know, very valid excuses for staying home, nonetheless are dedicated to Torah and Masorah in the most simple sense of the term. Today's topic is the daughters of Lot and their illustrious descendants. I'm assuming that the basic story of the daughters of Lot and how they're introduced in the Chumash is well known to us. The Torah tells us at the end of Perek Yud Tes in Sefer Bereishis, in Parashas Vayera, that the cities of Sodom and Amorah, all of those cities have just been destroyed, and Lot has managed to flee with his two daughters. Vayeshev ba'me'ora hu ushtei v'nosav. He goes into a cave with his two daughters. Vatomer habchira al hatzi'ira avinu zokein. The older daughter says to the younger daughter, look, our father is old. The ish ein ba'aretz lavo aleinu kederach kol ha'aretz. And as far as we're concerned, the entire world has been destroyed. That's the way Chazal understand the perspective that she takes. You know, they didn't have mass communication in those days. The entire world, from their perspective, were the cities of stone. They were just wiped off the face of the earth. As far as they know, they're the last people alive. What's going to happen to the human race? It's only us and our father. Let's go give our father a drink of wine. We'll get him drunk, and then we'll have relations with him. And let's give birth to children. We'll get pregnant as a result. We'll give birth to children. That's indeed what happens. Both daughters do this on successive nights. Vatelet habchiro bein. The older daughter gives birth to a son. Vatikra shmo Moav. She calls him Moav, which Rashi explains, Chazal explain, means May of, from the father. Hu avi Moav ad hayom. And the entire nation of Moav is descended from that child Moav. Vatsira gam hi olda bein, the younger daughter also had a child, a son. Vatikro shemo ben ami, she called her son the son of my nation. A little bit more oblique, but still the same basic idea. This is a child that comes from my own nation, from my own family. Hu avi bnei Amon ad hayom. He is the father. This child ends up being the father of the nation of Ammon, which again we know was one of the nations which bordered on Eretz Yisrael, and the Ammonim were often a source of difficulty to the Jewish people throughout the period of the Tanakh. We read the story. Yeah. Right, Enoch and Amram, it's a great question. What they might have thought, and again, it's just startling to consider, they might have considered doing the same thing. But again, it's an excellent point. It's not totally clear in the Chumash. Let's consider this story for a moment. That's the story the way it's told in the Chumash. I think the initial response that most people have when reading this story is disgust. It seems to be something depraved. Something, it's incestuous, right? Somebody just said it a moment ago. It's incestuous. It's, you know, whatever they were thinking, it's such a difficult story, such an uncomfortable story, such a disturbing story. I think in many elementary schools, if I'm not mistaken, they skip it. Right? That's the best way, the easiest way to deal with the story. Right? If you skip it, you don't have to explain it, you don't have to worry about it, you certainly don't have to explain it to a bunch of third graders, which, you know, you can understand why people want to do that. Why does the Torah bother sharing this story? Right? Well, this is a story which makes us feel very uncomfortable. Okay, good, so it explains where Ammon and Moab come from. All right, not everything do you have to know, right? The Torah is not just interested in giving us historical information, genealogical information. Everything that the Torah HaKadosh shares with us has some kind of deeper meaning and significance which resonates throughout the generations. Why bother sharing this story, which makes us feel so uncomfortable when we read it? Not only that, many of us probably know the statement of Chazal that as seemingly depraved and difficult as the story is on the surface, there's quote-unquote a happy ending many generations later. Let me quote to you from the Medrash Rabbah, which the Medrash Rabbah on Bereishis, Parshas Lech Lecha, Perek Mem Aleph, paragraph Dalet. So the Pasuk tells us in Bereishis, an earlier Pasuk in Bereishis, in Parshas Lech Lecha, that Vigam Lelot HaHoleches Avram, that Lot, who accompanied Avram Avinu, Hayotzon Uvakar Ve'oholim. He possessed sheep and cattle and tents. The Pasuk is trying to underscore how rich Lot was when Avram and his entourage left Mitzrayim to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Avram Avinu, Avram Kaved Ma'od, that's how the Pasuk starts off. Avram Avinu was very laden down by Kesef Uvazov. He had gold and silver and all kinds of precious items. V'gam L'Lot, HaHoleches Avram, HaYotzon Uvakar V'Oalim. Lot as well had sheep and cattle and tents. So the Medrash is bothered by the question. Sheep, a lot of sheep, I understand that's a sign of wealth. Cattle, I understand that's a sign of wealth. Nowadays, we don't deal in those kind of commodities, but to be honest, it's probably a safer bet than investing your money at this particular point in time. Maybe you should go out and buy a couple of cows. It might be a better thing to do with your money. Okay, good, but in the ancient world, that was a form of wealth. What's ohalim? Tents. Now, nowadays, we put money into real estate, but a tent is not like owning a house. It's not like owning an apartment. A tent is something you put up, and it doesn't really symbolize wealth. Why is the wealth of Lot described in terms of the fact that he had tents? So, Kamen Chazal, you know what these tents were? Rav Tuvia bar Yitzchok Omer, Shnei Ohalim. Tents over here is meant metaphorically. A tent is a reference to a woman. Someone who is the mainstay of the house, of the tent. There were two great women who would come out ultimately as descendants from Lot. Rus HaMoaviyah, Rus, who's a descendant of Moav, the older of the two children that Lot would father by his own daughters. V'Na'ama HaAmonis, and Na'ama, who was from Ammon. Na'ama was one of the wives of Shlomo HaMelech, and the mother of Rechavam, who was the son of Shlomo HaMelech, who ultimately took over the kingdom of Malchus Yehuda after Shlomo HaMelech's death. Right? So his mother, Rechavam's mother, was Na'ama HaAmonis. She was originally from Ammon. She came to the Jewish people. She converted. She married Shlomo HaMelech. Right? So these two women, Rusa Moaviyah, Na'ama HaAmonis, were direct descendants of Lot. They are Ohalim. They are tents. They are sources of virtue for the entire Jewish people. And that was the treasure. Those were the possessions that Lot had. We're not talking in physical terms, in spiritual terms. He was zocha to have two great women, Noshim Tzidkaniyos, who would come out from his descendants. So, to be honest, we're even more puzzled at this point. Right, so Lot engages in what seems to be a depraved act that's an incestuous relationship. And what happens? Two kids, Moav and Ammon, and two major Tzidkaniyos, two major righteous women, are descended from this Moav and this Ammon. Rus from Moav and Na'ama from Ammon. And these are not just two Noshim Tzidkaniyos. The entire future of the Jewish people rests on these two women. Because after all, Rus HaMoaviyah, as we know from Megillas Rus, is the great-grandmother of David HaMelech. And Na'ama HaAmonis is David HaMelech's daughter-in-law. Right? She's married to Shlomo HaMelech. Right? The entire future Malchus based David, the Davidic dynasty, which we know is so crucial to everything in Yahadus. I mean, we daven for the Davidic dynasty every day. As Semach David Avdecha Meheros Atzmiach, V'kano Torem B'shuasecha, K'lishuascha Kivinu Kol Hayom. The whole day, we're davening that Moshiach should come. Moshiach is a descendant of David HaMelech. Moshiach ultimately can trace back in his Yichus to Ammon and to Moav. So as difficult as we found the story to understand it before, as shared in the Chumash, this adds another layer of difficulty. Why does the Torah bother telling us this? And how can it be? How do we get our minds around the fact, conceptually, that this Maisa, this story, played such an important role in the future of the entire Jewish people? So I want to go through a couple of sources today to try to answer these questions, and to show how this seemingly depraved story is actually usually misunderstood by so many of us. First, let's just address a halachic question. I think if you ask the average person, it was mentioned here before, if you ask the average person, how would you describe what the daughters of Lot did? So most people would say it was incest. Well, that may be true from our kind of conventional perspective, but it's very, very important to note halachically that what they did was not incest, and in fact, was probably not even strictly speaking prohibited. Rabbi, what are you talking about? You know, you're telling me that a father is allowed to have relations with his daughter? So surprisingly enough, if you're a Ben Noach, meaning if you're not Jewish, but you're one of the Gentile nations of the world who are simply bound by the Shiva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, by the seven laws which HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to Adam HaRishon, and then after the flood to Noach, the answer is yes. This is not considered to be a prohibited form of incest. Really? Yeah. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin. It's a Rambam. The Rambam codifies this in Hilchos Malachim at the end of his Mishneh Torah. And basically both the Talmud and the Rambam make the same statement. It's not even the subject of a machlokes, of a dispute. When we talk about how the nations of the world are obligated to keep the laws of Gilui Arayos, they're not allowed to engage in prohibited relationships, say both the Talmud and the Rambam, there are six prohibited relationships which a non-Jew is not allowed to engage in. A man is not allowed to have relations with his mother, with his stepmother, with his sister, with a married woman, with a man, and with an animal. Those are the six. Anything else is permissible to a non-Jew. Right? To take one example, daughters. Right? I mean, to take our very example, for a man to have relations with his daughter, from a strict halachic perspective, again, let me just underscore this, for a non-Jew, is permissible. Right? That's not like a strange, far-out opinion or something like that. It's a passage in the Talmud. It's a Rambam. And as we'll see in a moment, one of the major commentaries among the medieval commentaries who writes extensively and very helpfully on this section in Chumash is the Rabbeinu Bechaye. Rabbeinu Bechaye was a student of the Ramban. And in his introduction to discussing this entire passage, he says the first thing you have to know is this is not halachically incest. Right? They did not engage in something which, from a Jewish point of view, would be prohibited. Now, let's very quickly add that, right? From a Jewish perspective, from a halachic perspective for Jews, a father having relations with his daughter is absolutely prohibited, right? But the gedarim, the guidelines of what's considered to be incest from a, you know, for Jews, are much more extensive than that which is prohibited to non-Jews. We have a whole series of relationships which are prohibited to us. But for a non-Jew, there are basically six, and this is not one of the six. You know, just as an aside, somebody asked me this question over Shabbos, which the person found a little bit puzzling. As much as what we might think intuitively doesn't always match up with the halacha, you know, and we see in this case, I think you ask the average person, you know, a father and his daughter, what is that? Well, that's clearly incest. Well, no, not so for a non-Jew. Even from the point of view what's prohibited for Jews, what we think intuitively is not always in accordance with the halacha, right? Some just asked me the Shabbos, I don't know why the question came up, can cousins marry one another in halacha? Now, in New York State law, I believe they can't, first cousins, right? Right? But in halacha, it's totally permissible. Not only that, but in halacha, one of the other things which is permissible is for an uncle to marry a niece. Not only is it permissible, but it's clear that in Talmudic times it was a very common practice. It was a way of extending protection to a young niece who might otherwise have been vulnerable if she was left on her own. Again, I think that's probably prohibited according to New York State law as well, if I'm not mistaken, an uncle and a niece. I'm not sure. But again, that's an example, just another example where something which we think intuitively might be problematic from a strict halachic point of view. I'm not saying you should necessarily go out and do it, but from a strict halachic point of view, you know, what we think offhand doesn't always jive with what the halacha actually says is usur or mutter. So that's the very first point which you have, before you go any further in understanding this parasha, you have to understand this is not incest. It's not halachically prohibited as incest. They're non-Jews. Nobody claims that Lot was Jewish. Nobody claims that his daughters were Jewish. The relationship they had, even though it might strike us as unappetizing, but it wasn't halachically prohibited. It wasn't incestuous. And in fact, says the Rabbeinu Bechaye, you see this in the psukim themselves, because there's a word which the Torah consistently uses for describing prohibited relationships, which is absent from the psukim. The word znus, promiscuity, or any form thereof, is not to be found in these psukim. It wasn't promiscuity. Promiscuity is only that which is prohibited. This was permissible. At that time, not just for that time, but for non-Jews, this is considered to be permissible. So that's the first thing we have to understand, right? So in terms of judging the daughters of Lot, we have to understand that what they're doing is certainly not considered to be incestuous. Chazal tell us, in fact, that the daughters of Lot were miskaven l'shem shamayim. They were totally pure in their intentions. And the truth is, when you read the psukim, that flows out of the psukim themselves. They're not interested in fulfilling some kind of physical desire for the sake of desire. Their intent is to populate the world. As far as they're concerned, the world has been pretty much destroyed, with the exception of themselves and their father. They see themselves as doing something which is unappetizing, it's personally revolting, it's mutter, but it's personally revolting, but they're willing to do it because that's going to keep humanity going. In a tremendous sense, that's mesiras nefesh. That's giving of oneself, doing something which under normal circumstances would be revolting or unappetizing or, you know, disturbing, hard for a person to do, but I'm willing to do it for some kind of greater good. Chazal, right, they were miskaving. They had in mind l'shem shamayim. More than that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in on their plan. Why do I say HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in on their plan? Well, two things. First, the pasuk says, it's pasuk Lamed Gimel, when the older daughter, decides that night she gives her father wine and proceeds to have relations with him. The pasuk says, "Vatashkena es avihen yayin balayla hu." They gave their father to drink wine on balayla hu. So the simple way you translate those two words, balayla hu, is that night. But if you know Hebrew grammar, there's a letter missing over here. It should be balayla hahu, right? You remember from the Megillah, balayla hahu, nadado shnas hamelech, right? Achashverosh couldn't sleep on that night. The hey is missing. So what do you mean balayla hu? So says the Rabbeinu Bechaye. And it's interesting, Chazal say this elsewhere in a different context, but they don't say it over here. The Rabbeinu Bechaye says it over here. You know what it means? Vatashkena es avihen yayin balayla. In the night, they gave their father to drink. And who orchestrated all of this? Who? He did. HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chvodo uve'atzmo was moving the chess pieces on the board to ensure that these daughters would be successful with their plan. God wanted them to be matzliach. He wanted this act to come to fruition. More than that, the Rabbeinu Bechaye quotes in support of this idea a medrash. The medrash asks a question which, you know, till the medrash asked it, I never thought about it. But if you think about it, it's a pretty decent question. So they say, let's take some wine and get our father drunk. Where exactly did they get this wine from? Right? The entire area has been destroyed. Right? They ran out of stone as quickly as they could. It's reasonable to assume that if you're packing to escape from an inferno, you don't say, oh, wait a minute, you know, I have to run down to the wine cellar just to pull out a couple of bottles to get out there. Okay, good. So they probably didn't take it when they left stone. Now they come to the cave. They don't have any wine with them. And they say, let's, you know, give our father a drink of wine. And where are you going to get the wine from? What, you're going to call Skyview Liquors and have them deliver? Where's the wine going to come from? Even if you tell me you're going to squeeze grapes, but it has to have time to ferment. I mean, we're talking about something that's happening overnight. Where did they get the wine from? So the Medrash writes, Kodesh Baruch Hu made a nes, and a stream of wine miraculously appeared in the cave. Oh, great. We picked the right cave. This just happens to be a cave with a stream of wine. Okay, we'll take some cups, and we'll do what we have to do. Now, why is HaKadosh Baruch Hu making miracles in order to bring about what on the surface would seem to be something depraved? Right? So, says the Rabbeinu Bechai, you see from here that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a vested interest in having this act come to fruition. It's not that we're trying to sweep it under the rug or dismiss it or do anything like that. Something very holy, with the assistance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, is happening at this moment in time. And says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'll even make sure that you have the wine to carry out your plans. What's more, there's a fascinating medrash where the medrash points to one word in the parsha which casts this whole story in a different light. The older daughter goes to the younger daughter and she says, L'cha nashkes ovinu yayin v'nishkeva imo, let's go do this act, we'll give our father wine. Unechayeme ovinu zora, and we will bring forth from our father seed, zera. Says the Medrash, zera is to be understood as a particular seed or a particular descendant. And say Chazal, zera equals Moshiach. In other words, when the older daughter is going to the younger daughter and saying, you know, let's do this particular act, she explicitly says to the younger daughter, because we want to bring forth Moshiach from our actions. And indeed, as we noted before, that's what happens. I mean, down the line somewhat. But Moav and Ammon come out of this union. Rus and Naama ultimately are descended from Moav and from Ammon. And Moshiach Tzidkenu is ultimately going to be descended from Rus and from Naama. That's not just incidental, says the Medrash. That was part of the plan from the very beginning. Unechayeme avinu zora, Moshiach. Let's bring forth Moshiach from this act. So here we're getting a very different picture of the story than what we thought at first glance. Here are two holy women who are being moser nefesh to do something which is essentially mutter, but just unappealing, unappetizing, somewhat revolting, but we're ready to do it. Why? Not just to help out humanity right now, but to bring forth Moshiach Tzidkenu. Something much deeper is happening here than meets the eye. But still, we have to answer the question in order to put all of this in perspective. Why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu want Moshiach himself and the whole Malchus Beis David to emerge in such a bizarre fashion? Clearly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have brought about the Davidic dynasty in different ways. Why bidavka bring forth the Malchus Beis David and Moshiach Tzidkenu from, okay, it's not Osir, good, it's not Osir, but it's still bizarre, it's still strange. Why do that? Why do it in this fashion? This is a beautiful, yeah. What's that? Right. Because Naama is David's daughter-in-law. Shlomo HaMelech is married to Naama, right? Moshiach is going to come through Shlomo, right? In other words, David, Shlomo, Rechavam. And that's the, Moshiach doesn't just come through David HaMelech. He comes through the line of Shlomo HaMelech and all the subsequent Melachim. So Naama is also a piece of the picture. Now, there's a beautiful insight which I first heard from my own Rosh Hashiva, Reb Chaim Yaakov Goldberg, Seichet Tzadik Livracha, the Hashiva Karen Biavna, Eretz Yisrael. And he quoted this many times from the Shem Yishmuel. Shem Yishmuel, one of the great Hasidic works, the Sokotchov Rebbe. So the Shem Yishmuel was a grandson of the Kotzke Rebbe. The way the lineage worked, the Kotzke Rebbe, the famous Kotzke Rebbe, had a son-in-law, the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer's son was the Shem Yishmuel. The Avnei Nezer and the Shem Yishmuel were both the rebbes of the Sokotchov Chassidim. So the Shem Yishmuel writes as follows: Hinei zikeni mikotsk omar. The inyan hamalucha lohaya nimtsa bi Yisrael, v'hayud tzrichin likach zos me amon umoav. Says the Shem Yishmuel. The Shem Yishmuel writes this in his comments on the Yontiv of Shavuos. So the Shem Yishmuel writes. He quotes from Ezeida, from the Kotzke Rebbe. The reason that Moshiach, that David, that Shlomo HaMelech ultimately had to come out from Ammon and Moab was because the concept of kingship did not exist in the Jewish people. And the only way that an idea of royalty or kingship could ever be infused into Klal Yisrael was to take it from foreign sources, was to take it from Ammon u'Moav. Ad kan, in the Lashon of the Shem Yishmuel, ad kan l'shono ha-kodesh. That's all the Kotzker said. The Kotzker said the reason that this whole Maisa had to take place in order to bring about Moshiach Tzidkenu was because there was no concept of royalty in Klal Yisrael. It could only come from outside sources, from Ammon u'Moav. Okay, what does that mean? So says the Shem Yishmuel, Vapirish Poshut. It's obvious what my Zayda meant. Let me tell you what my Zayda meant. Ki ba'asher kol Yisrael ki ish echad heima. The Jewish people are all ultimately one unit. Right? We're all together. Chaveirim kol Yisrael. So eino shayich she'echad yistorer al chaveiro. If we're all one, it's impossible for any Jew to rule over any other Jew. Kumo she'ein ha'ever ha'echad she'ba'odam mistarer Allah ever ha'acher. Just as no limb in the body can rule over any other limb, you know, I may be a righty, but my right arm isn't ruling over my left arm. I'm all one unit. I'm all one organism. The Jewish people is united. We are all one. And if we're all one, it can't be that someone is going to be able to rule over someone else. You know, the famous statement, you know, we're all equal, but some are more equal than others. Right? So that can't be true. That can't be true, says the Sakhachavar. If we're all equal, if we're all one, there's no such thing that some are more equal than others. We're all one unit. Nobody can, the concept of Malchus is foreign to the Jewish people. I, Moshe Rabbeinu, was called a Melech, right? Vahivishur and Melech, Bisasef Rosh Hayom. Says the Sakhachav, the only way that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to be a Melech was because he was so distinct from the rest of Klal Yisrael. He spoke to God, ponim al ponim, face to face. So that put him in a different category. So you can't bring me a proof for Moshe Rabbeinu. Other than Moshe Rabbeinu, it wouldn't be possible to have a concept of one Jew ruling over another Jew. Al kein hoyso nefesh David HaMelech tumua b'shivya b'soch klipas moav kedei lahotzi inyan ha'yisnasus mehaklipa. Therefore, says the Sakhachavar, you know where you find the concept of brazenness, of chutzpah, of gaiva, of haughtiness, of pride, which are all necessary elements in order to enable one person to be able to rule over someone else. You have to have a certain amount of shtolz, as they say, in order to be able to rule over someone else. You know who had that? Klal Yisrael didn't have that. Only Moav and Ammon had that. They were nations which were characterized by a sense of haughtiness, by a sense of brazenness. We'll see how we come to that in just a minute. But these were haughty and brazen nations. Now, normally we say that to be haughty and to be brazen is not a good thing. We don't want our kids growing up to be haughty and brazen. But you know what? If you want a melech, if you want somebody to be in power and control over other people, a little bit of that, a little bit of that haughtiness and that brazenness, you're going to have to use. Because if you're in charge, if so to speak, the buck stops here, that means that at a certain point, some people are going to want to do things, and you're going to have to tell them no. That's what it means to be in charge. That's what it means to be a melech. Where do the Jewish people get that koach from, that ability, that brazenness, that shtolz to be able to carry on a melucha? They can only get it from an outside source, from Ammon and Moav, which are characterized by that brazenness. Says the Shem Yishmuel more than that. That's why the kingship of Shaul ultimately failed. Shaul wasn't from Ammon and Moav. He had nice, great yichus. He came from the Shevet of Binyamin. Right? There were no funny things going on in his background or anything like that. And Shaul HaMelech, we know, ultimately was not successful in being a king. Why? So says the Shem Yishmol, because the truth is, he was too nice a person. He didn't have the shtolts. What's the story we're going to read about in the Haftarah, you know, right before Purim? HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Shaul HaMelech, go wipe out the nation of Amalek. The people go to Shaul and they say, why are you wiping out the whole nation? We should take the save the animals. You know, we can make them into karbanos. We can do good things with them. So Shaul says, okay. What do you mean, okay? You're in charge. Shmuel Hanavi goes to Shaul HaMelech afterwards and he says, Halo im koton ato be'enecha, ro shivtei Yisrael ato. I know you're a humble person. Shaul HaMelech is where we get the phrase nechbo el hakelim, hiding behind the vessels, to describe a humble person. Shaul HaMelech didn't want to be anointed. He was an anav. He was a tremendously humble person. 9 times out of 10, that's a great midah for a person to have. But if you're going to be a leader, you have to be able to put your foot down when it's necessary. You can't always be a nice guy who gets along with everybody. Right? They say it about Rabbanim. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter once said that if you have a rav that everybody loves and nobody has any problems with him, he's not a rav. Right? We try to be makpid, you know, to keep it to a minimum, but a little bit, you know, you have, on occasion, a person has to put his foot down. I mean, that's part of being in a leadership position. It goes with the territory. Says the Shem Yishmol, Shaul HaMelech lost the Malchus. He couldn't be king anymore, because if you just do what everybody wants you to do, if you don't have that shtolz, which David HaMelech had, and which he had gotten from Ammon and Moab, then ultimately, you're not going to be successful in a position of leadership. Where do we see that brazenness in Ammon and Moab? So the truth is, if we go back to our parsha, we see it in the parsha itself. And here again, I'll share with you another comment from the Rabbeinu Bechaye. The pasuk says, the older daughter says to the younger daughter, Lecha nashke es ovinu yayin v'nishkevo imo. Let's go, and we'll give our father wine, and we'll perform this particular act. So Rabbeinu Bechaye points out that the word lecha, right, which is spelled in the Chumash, like the word lech, you know, to go, you know, laleches, lamid, chaf, hey, is really in the masculine form. If one woman says to another woman, let's go, the proper Hebrew usage is lechi. Lecha is masculine. So says the Rabbeinu Bechaye, so why is that? Why is the masculine form of the verb being utilized over here? So says the Rabbeinu Bechaye, because the truth is, they acted in a brazen type of way which we would normally associate more with a man. When it comes to relationships, when it comes to relations, generally speaking, it's more of the role of the man to initiate. The fact that they put themselves out in this fashion wasn't feminine, says the Rabbeinu Bechaye. They were acting in a masculine fashion. So, lecha, as opposed to lechi. And the very fact that when they named the children names, they give them names which tell the whole story. Mo'ov, from the father. So who asked you to publicize that? So, okay, good. You did what you did because you thought it was right, and it was right, and it was good, and you had God's blessing, and he gave you wine. Okay, everything's wonderful. So call him Shimmy, you know? Like what? You have to call him Mo'ov. You have to call him Amon ben Ami, a child that comes from my own nation. You know, like, not everything that happens has to be publicized. No. But that was exactly the point. Because this was not simply a way of perpetuating the human race. These daughters, these Nashim Tzidkaniyos, right, these righteous women, wanted to create a certain element of positive brazenness. Sometimes you have to be proactive. Sometimes you have to be a little bit haughty. Sometimes you have to take charge when nobody else is taking charge. Those aren't Jewish midos most of the time. Jews in general, as Chazal say, are Baishanim, B'nai Baishanim. We're humble people, we're quiet people, we're simple people. We don't look to push, we don't look to be proactive, you know, in terms of pushing an agenda against people. No, that's not our nature. But sometimes you need to do it. And these two women created that midah, which would be passed on for generation after generation. In Moab, in Ammon, in Moab and in Ammon, it was taken to an extreme. But the little bit of that, which was borrowed by David HaMelech, and ultimately by Moshiach Tzidkenu, to be able to create the basis of Jewish monarchy, a little bit of that brazenness, a little bit of that haughtiness, a little bit of that proactive stance, a little bit of that shtoltz, that was absolutely necessary in order to instill malchus, kingship, a regal position in Klal Yisrael. That's why the Maisa, that's why the story is so important. Because the story really has two levels of importance. Number one, it tells us that Malchus and Moshiach ben David was planned by God in conjunction with these Noshim Tzidkanios. The concept that a little bit of shtoltz had to be instilled into Klal Yisrael was part of the plan from the very beginning. And it's really a privilege to read about how HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought that about. And there's a little bit of a lesson for us as well. This is what we just learned is a lesson in terms of Jewish history, but there's a lesson for ourselves as well. Sometimes when a person is in a position of leadership, there are times when a person has to act in a way which would be inappropriate for a non-leader. We're supposed to be Baishanim B'nai Baishanim. Yes, we're supposed to be, in general, we're supposed to be humble, quiet, simple people. But if you try to run a malchus that way, you try to run a kingdom that way, or any position of leadership, you're retiring, nechba el hakelim, people will walk all over you, and ultimately you won't be able to be mekayim, you won't be able to fulfill God's word. A little bit of shtoltz is necessary in order to be a proper leader. There's a fascinating story which took place less than 100 years ago regarding the Benos Lot, and it opens up in a totally different way of acknowledging the tremendous nature of the act in which they engaged. They were not doing something chalila which was depraved or disgusting or anything of that nature. We have to view their act as an act of tzidkus, an act of righteousness of the highest order. So up till now we've seen how, from one perspective, let me share with you a true story that happened, again, less than 100 years ago, which shares a very different but fascinating perspective on the same story. Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, used to tell people this story, and I heard it from members of the family, and it dates back to when he was a Rav in Luban, in Russia, in the early part of the 20th century. It was Parshas Vayera, the parsha in which we read the story of Benos Lot. And there was a learned individual who was in shul with everybody else. They were laning Parshas Vayera in shul, Shabbos morning. They get up to the story of Benos Lot, and all of a sudden, this learned individual goes into a trance. I don't know what exactly happened. His eyes rolled up. You know, he looked very much like he was another world, and then he collapsed. No, so they take the person, they bring him back home, they revive him, and after he's revived, Rav Meisher, the Rav of the town, comes to see him to be Mevakir Chola. And the individual tells him the following story. Says this person, "You should know, Rebbe, you should know, that I was always bothered by the story of Benos Lot. How could they have done what they did? And then how could they publicize it to call Moav, to call Ammon? You know, all the questions we've been dealing with throughout the presentation of this session. So you know what happened this Shabbos, the man tells Rav Moshe, this Shabbos, as we were learning the Parsha, the B'nos Lot came to me in a vision. And they told me the following story. They said, you think that we did something disgusting, depraved, terrible? You know why we did what we did, and you know why we called our children Moav and Ammon? Because you know what we could have easily done after this story took place? We could have easily told the world, you know how it is that we're pregnant? It was a miracle. It was immaculate conception. And you don't think that they would have believed us? They would have believed us. I'll give you the biggest proof that they would have believed us. Just fast forward a couple centuries later in history. But we bedavka named our children Moav and Ammon to refute the concept of immaculate conception. We wanted the world to know that if a man and his two daughters go into a cave together and the daughters come out pregnant, the child is not from God. The child is me'av. The child is ben ami. We put our reputations on the line in order to make this theological point. There's no such thing as what a friend of mine referred to once as the immaculate misconception, right? There is no such thing out there. And yeah, it was embarrassing for us. It was difficult for us. I mean, you can imagine, you know, it's certainly not the thing you'd want to talk about. But we wanted to make it, we wanted to put it on the record, l'dore doros, for generations hence. A few days later, the man passed away. Ramesha used to tell this story. It's a totally different perspective on the tzidkus of these two women. But one thing that it brings out is that their kavanas were totally l'shem shamayim in everything that they were doing. Kosh Baruch Hu should bless us that in our own lives we should be zocha to emulate the midos of baishanus, of, you know, the shyness, the retiring nature which generally characterizes the Jewish people. And when we need shtolts, we should be able to draw on the example of Dovid HaMelech, Rus HaMoaviyah, Namo HaAmonis, from whence it came.